more time. 1990-1991, and try and render it as smooth and complete as possible. And I just have two tape recordings sent, one as a handout. And also, we're going to have more handouts, and we're going to do the full production. All of this has been more or less like a rehearsal, but the full production starts in the meantime. So I'm gearing up towards that. If you sense that I'm talking in a little more detail, because it's time to do this in this level. We have five textbooks, plus a textbook which is for the interview. That is to say, five of them are for the 3 months, and the sixth text is for the 13th week. Levels and the 14th level that are coming. So that 14 becomes an alcohol. Right at the beginning of the Gospel according to Matthew, the sequence of 14 is shown. It's 14 generations between Abraham and David, 14 generations between David and Jesus. Because the
One of the most famous of Haydn's London symphonies, the Symphony No. 101 in D major, because of the tick-tock kind of rhythm in its second movement. It's known, of course, as the Clock Symphony. On that Angels CD, the English Chamber Orchestra was conducted by Geoffrey Tate. There's one other Haydn symphony on Angels CD. That's the Symphony No. 99 in E-flat. Geoffrey Tate doing Haydn very well, thank you, on modern instruments. Jim Schweda will be along in just a moment. We're presenting a repeat broadcast this morning of Jim Schweda's program in which he compares recordings of the Shostakovich Fifth Symphony. The Record Shelf Guide to Gift Recordings is postponed, and we will keep you posted on when you'll hear that broadcast this season. Jim Schweda will be along with the Record Shelf in just a moment, then at 12 a program of Weekend Classics with Gene Parrish. And do remember to tune in next week, all through the week, very special programming for American Music Week here on 91.5, KUSC Los Angeles, KFAC Santa Barbara, and KCPB Thousand Oaks, the public.
It is unquestionably the most popular of the composer's 15 symphonies. It has probably been performed more frequently than all the others put together. And Serge Koussevitzky claimed it was the only 20th century work that could be mentioned in the same breath with the Beethoven Fifth. It remains the subject of a heated debate. After everything which precedes it, is the famous boisterous finale a giddy reaffirmation of life or a grim practical joke played on the Soviet censors? An empty, hollow, nose-thumbing gesture by one of the most sarcastic composers who has ever lived. In the next hour, we're going to examine this powerful and mysterious work through a few of its many recordings. This is Jim Schweda welcoming you to the Record Shelf. In the next hour, the comparative survey of the recordings of the Symphony No. 5 by Dmitri Shostakovich.
The electron goes to another energy level. You have a different element. This is how the transmutation happens. One transmutes lead by gold by energy. But in order to raise the energy, one has to raise the entire energy of the previous structure to its transformation point. Put it bluntly, you can't break the opening
The trouble started on an evening in 1936, when the tin-eared Joseph Stalin decided to take in a performance of Dmitri Shostakovich's opera, Lady Macbeth of Mtsinsk, then enjoying a triumphant production at Moscow's Bolshoi Theater. First performed 2 years earlier, the opera had already been mounted to great acclaim in the West, and was well on its way to becoming a modern Soviet classic, when Pravda, on the day after Stalin's visit, denounced it vehemently as a farrago of chaotic, nonsensical sounds. Deeply shaken, the composer canceled the upcoming premiere of his Fourth Symphony and began work on a new piece, which would ultimately bear the subtitle A Soviet Artist's Reply to Just Criticism. The extent to which the composer actually believed that is still an open question. What is not open to question is the fact that the new work is the most gripping and powerful that Shostakovich had so far produced.
But the announcement. participation. From the sevenness is an eight, which she can't count. Nevertheless, it's still occurring. The eight is not a step in itself. It's not a relation in itself. It is
the recent Philips recording by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Semyon Bychkov, has much to recommend it. Stunning playing by the Berlin Philharmonic, state-of-the-art recorded sound, and an interpretation which is unusually subtle and mature for a conductor of Bychkov's relatively tender years. In fact, if his approach to the symphony's famous ominous opening bars can be criticized for anything, it would be that they are a little too subtle and restrained, lacking the oomph and forward thrust of a performance like this.
Not because of my particular imaginative genius or anything, but it's the 21st century version of the tradition. It's always there.
Bernhard Haitink's version of the Fifth is one of the most satisfying recordings from his ongoing Shostakovich symphony cycle. The Amsterdam Concertgebouw Orchestra plays the work as though they owned it, and the conductor misses few opportunities to let the symphony make both its rarefied and overwhelming points. In short, Haitink shows his typical authority as a Shostakovich conductor, as does one of the composer's closest musical and personal friends.
Based on silicon chips that are not linear in their logical capacities, but on neutrons in their biological.
When the man who may well have been the world's greatest cellist embarked on his career as the world's greatest amateur conductor, the initial results were disappointing, to say the very least. As a matter of fact, it was not until 1983, with the release of this Shostakovich Fifth, that Mstislav Rostropovich, the conductor, made a genuinely satisfying recording. And while Washington's National Symphony is clearly no match for the Concertgebouw Orchestra or the Berlin Philharmonic, they play their hearts out for their emotional conductor, who, in passages like this one, asks for and receives playing, which is suitably dark, sinister, and grotesque. Bernhard Haitink has always had the reputation of being an especially adroit and civilized conductor. When the score calls for it, he can out-grotesque even Rostropovich, as this macabre reading clearly shows.
Thank you.
The only conductor with two recordings of the Shostakovich Fifth currently in circulation is Leonard Bernstein. The more recent was recorded live in Tokyo during a New York Philharmonic tour of Japan. The earlier dates from 1959 in Boston's Symphony Hall, shortly after the orchestra and conductor had returned from a triumphant tour of the Soviet Union. While the newer version isn't half bad, the older one remains one of the finest recordings that Bernstein has ever made. A rich, colorful, hugely dramatic interpretation, which crackles with energy and biting wit. Predictably, Bernstein is at his absolute best when the music is at its most dramatic. In the sardonic second movement, for instance, the playing is as heavy and ponderous as it is snide and razor sharp.
In the very the second textbook here is called The Particle Explosion, published by Oxford University Press. Both these books were just published a few years ago. So The Particle Explosion and The Cosmological Distance Light. These two go together. The structure of the very large.
Shostakovich, in comparison, seems almost too refined and gentlemanly here, to say nothing of lumpy and sluggish.
The one which has been around life is older than this particular planetary body, than this particular star system that we inhabit. Life is older than the star.
Semyon Bychkov is sharper in his details and far more willing to play around with the scherzo's tempos.
Is the center of these two things, and the book textbook is the philosophy of God's which forbids us from recognizing it in a natural way, so that we have to go to a supernatural inner sight to even begin to envision what it is. Or even on the most basic existential level, that it is.
And Bernhard Haitink, who is one of music's consummate gentlemen, makes the music lumber off like a drunken peasant with this wonderfully droll effect.
Allows for it to manifest in the world of appearance. The numinal insight is instantaneous. There's no time whatsoever. Like one could listen to one part to himself, your soul will take it back.
The structural and emotional heart of the Fifth Symphony, the Great Largo, is probably the finest slow movement that any composer had written after Mahler. And the Haydn recording throughout underscores the Mahlerian connection with playing that ranges from enormous outbursts of grief to the most serene sort of detachment.
Going every which way, and oh yeah, 5 years ago, that's right. I was feeling that, and now here it is again. It's like in medieval Greek, this is the touch of the and you don't know it for later, but you will miss by the one.
Rostropovich, at the beginning of the movement, is suitably silent and mysterious, but the playing of the National Symphony itself tends to lose concentration from time to time, and at times becomes uncomfortably slack.
Is Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching. The Tao Te Ching is exactly the right hidden arcane underside to complementarity in the philosophy of Niels Bohr. Quantum mechanics, the Tao of physics. Kepler's insight was very accurate. And he did the best he could to try and express it. It's somewhat tempered by mitigating circumstances, not the least is because my Zumi and Roshi is somewhat tempered. And so there's that situation to say, hey, you know, used to pass this version, not at all. Just that it added to the opacity or capacity of Kepler's ability. But Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching is exactly the right mode of bringing up the arcane quality of the sun. So much so that when one is able to read Lao Tzu.
And then there is the Bernstein recording, which begins on a note of desolate, inconsolable tragedy.
Back at primordial nature again. So at the end of the science section, you're all set to come back to the beginning. You're all set to come back to nature again and pick up the portable Thoreau. So on New Year's Eve, December 31st, 1989, if you can read Lao Tzu with a scientific mind, you can wake up January 1st and pick up Thoreau and really enjoy it. Really. It's a sweetness not to be missed. To be able to go on a walk with Thoreau. Thoreau says in his great little writing on walking, he says...
At the great climax of the third movement, Bernstein pulls out all the stops, then utters a riveting, heart-wrenching cry of despair. Still, for all its intensity, the passage remains admirably contained and controlled. The Bitschkoff recording, alas, badly misfires here, and thus effectively takes itself out of the run. Which is a tremendous pity, since up to this almost lackadaisical moment, the movement,
and indeed the entire
performance, had much to admire and to respect.
The two books to pick up that we'll see are one in the same book. And when we finish dealing with establishing the first pick, I'm going to need a light. And over the next 4 weeks, I'm going to try to establish the second pick. Cosmological distance gathering is part of the experiment. These two books are going to come in great groups.
And then there is Bernard Haitink, who not only builds the climax like the master orchestral craftsman he is, but also infuses the music with a sinuously beautiful expressiveness. In the symphony's controversial finale, Haitink begins at a very measured pace, only to quicken the tempo in a very exciting way. Shostakovich almost staggers into the final movement, with a tempo so ponderous that it seems in imminent danger of falling apart. Things become quickly and agreeably crazy, however, though again, the National Symphony is just barely able to keep up with its conductor's excessive demands.
It doesn't matter if you're a genius, but if you're ordinary, struggling, mediocre, it's very, very difficult. And the original work of the government started with.
And then there is the Bernstein recording. which leaves the gate like a shot and simply gets more and more frenetic along the way. Closing bars of the Rolf Dobrovitch recording present the revised standard version of the symphony's ultimate meaning, as presented in the composer's posthumous and still controversial memoir, Testimony. In essence, the argument is that the apparent exaltation of the final movement is in fact the thinly veiled cry of a man with a knife at his back. A very canny artist giving the impression of a Soviet artist replying to all that just criticism. It's a fascinating alternative point of view, and one that very nearly works. Unfortunately, for all its undeniably ironic grandeur, the Rostropovich performance simply collapses of its own weight.
This is why, when you look at one of the great classics of Alchemist in his laboratory, and you see not only are
Heitink, on the other hand, stands somewhere between the revisionist view of the movement and the traditional pre-testimony approach. The Konzertgebouw Orchestra roars magnificently, and the Philips engineers capture every exhilarating decibel to perfection.
Leonard Bernstein, whose recording was made long before the revisionists got hold of this electrifying score. With no hidden agenda or secretive interpretive points to make, Bernstein simply cuts loose and lets the notes fall where they may. It might not be what the composer actually intended, but for a misguided, old-fashioned view of the music, its pure animal energy is difficult to match.
Your nirvana and all this is very well, but aren't you ever curious to go to the moon?
As a performance of a great 20th century symphony, the Bernstein version of the Shostakovich Fifth has remained a unique document for nearly 30 years. And strangely enough, for a man who had such a decisive influence on the modern Mahler revival, it is not to that composer that Bernstein draws the closest parallels, but instead to someone else. For in this brooding, extroverted, and frankly romantic interpretation, Bernstein seems intent on viewing Shostakovich as the heir and logical successor of that other great Russian symphonist, Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky. Again, this may not be where this important, puzzling, and still problematic piece eventually belongs, but as a provisional solution to the problem, it is one that certainly works.
What is the carbon-based pattern?
Here are the final two movements of the Symphony No. 5 in D minor, Opus 47, by Dmitri Shostakovich, from a recording made in Symphony Hall, Boston, in 1959. The New York Philharmonic is conducted by Leonard Bernstein.
I'm trying to move you from that pair to a second pair. The astronomically large universe and the atomically particle very small universe. I'm trying to speak to them by showing that what guarantees life's form is the plasma membrane, the seal of life, so that it maintains its form, at least for a reasonable time period, is the plasma membrane. The seal that holds the silicon chip is its design. But the only relation is that this thing, as long as you have the pair, as long as you only have the pair, the best that you can do in resolving it is to get exactly in the center and to have your mind exactly in the center at six of one, half a dozen of the other. That's easier. The best you can do in integrating a pair is to get dead even. The right way to integrate the pair is to bring the complementary pair to the pair. Then you can integrate to the center. If you have but one pair, the center is halfway in between the two and is a dead zone. It's a limbo. The perfect integration, there would be a perfect limbo. But when you have two pairs, when you have a quaternary, the center becomes trigonometric in its structural capacity. It generates a sphere of consciousness rather than just a point of complete limbo. This is why all linear thought processes, even when brought to perfection, lead to the abundance. They perfectly done lead to the abundance. And this is why psychic energy, which is tuned up by these linear thought processes, when it follows the natural development of trying to perfect itself, it leads to a by itself. And the only way to stop that, to restore that, to do that, is be self-sabotaging. You can't blame life for sabotaging thought when that's what's going to happen. The heart says, no way, man. You're not going to think clear enough to get into that state. I have a few problems. Young lady, how about a truly errant lover, to really screw up things? Here you are, here's my effect. But can you see that life is trying to forestall the perfection of a nightmare? Whereas if you have the fulsome process, which can lead to some resolution, non-nightmare style, all of the self-sabotaging qualities transmute themselves to helpers.
Yes.
Let's do this. So when the sound says you try to win, our second pair, I will get to next week, and I'll start talking about next week. And we'll start with one of the most interesting of all questions. How far is a star? And how would we ever know? And if we can find out how far a star is, how would we ever know how far a galaxy is? And when we see a 1990 schematic showing that if one took a 2 million light year sphere, there's a whole family of galaxies, of which ours is the second largest, and that this family of galaxies have lived together since the beginning of time, and that the gulf between this family of galaxies and the next family of galaxies is truly staggering, unbelievably staggering. That not only the distances between stars and star systems, but the distances between galaxies which are nearby to us from galaxies in the next family are horrendously enormous. When you talk about a gulf, the gulf between planets turns out to be almost paper thin, less than paper thin. Let's start. Let's use a technique to the Bruno Pioneer. If our sun were the size of the Great Bear, the Earth would be 6 inches away from that kind of imaginary Great Bear. Why do we know it would be 6 inches? Because otherwise, the comparative analysis would not be you can make it 6 feet if you want. It won't make any difference to your imagination. The Earth is 6 feet from that great group. The nearest star is around Denver, Colorado. And most of the stars that you would see in the sky would be further away than the Earth on that little scale. If we see a diagram with a 2 million light year sphere, it barely encompasses the family of galactic structures, the Milky Way, the clusters of families of galaxies extend from all worlds to magical distances. How do we know this? How can anyone know this? That's what this book is about, the cosmological distance.